It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Welcome into episode 4 of the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. Once again, this episode is packed with all sorts of extra content. I didn't necessarily plan it this way, but this week's episode has a Second Amendment and outdoor conservation theme. My first guest is a conservative millennial, which may seem like a contradiction in terms. Her name is Gabriella Hoffman, and she has a fascinating story to tell. The daughter of refugees from the former Soviet Union, Gabriella is all about the freedoms afforded by the United States of America. A prolific writer, Gabby's articles have appeared at The Resurgent, Field and Stream, Yahoo News, and many other outlets. You really also ought to check out her podcast, The District of Conservation. She and I talk about a conservative message on conservation that can work, the importance of the Second Amendment, and the evils of socialism. You can follow Gabriella on Twitter at Gabby_Hoffman. Gabriella also recorded a bonus segment exclusively for our Patreon patrons. It's a full extra hour of me and Gabriella riffing on politics. Subscribers get access to this kind of exclusive material and many other features. Check it out at patreon.com/behindthecurtainwithjeffreynolds. My second guest is Josiah Underwood, who is the Director of Operations of Radian Weapons. Radian is a gun manufacturer based in Redmond, Oregon, which is bold enough on its face, but Radian also sponsors the Rally to Save the Second Amendment in Salem, Oregon, which comes up on March 23rd. Radian has put its money where its mouth is, putting up $100,000 of its own money to sponsor the event and hire charter buses from all corners of Oregon to bring activists in for the event. Josiah and I discuss the foundational importance of the Second Amendment to all liberties protected by the U.S. Constitution. You can find Radian on Facebook at facebook.com/radianweapons. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like iTunes and Google Podcasts, among many others. Also, buy my book. It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Search for it in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Welcome into the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. I'm here with my special guest today, Gabriella Hoffman. Gabriella is a young go-getter, a young conservative who is interested in conservation issues and how the conservatives can take back the messaging on those issues. So welcome in, Gabriella.
Thank you, Jeff, for having me. It's good to talk to a fellow resurgent writer. And congratulations on the launch of your podcast and for publishing your first book. If I'm not mistaken,
yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it's thanks for the plug. It's called Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. So we were talking a little bit in the before we started recording here about some of these groups, these supposedly conservative conservation groups. And I wonder how much of them are getting funding from the left. You know, I think there might be a couple.
Yeah, and not just them, but there are a lot of hunting groups, and I'm not one to gossip or to unmask because I try to operate more behind the scenes with criticism of certain groups, but I'm all about working with different types of conservation groups if we have similarly aligned goals. But a lot of groups, you'll be surprised, regardless of the sector, it could be pro-life, it could be, abortion, conservation. You even find among hunting groups, there are some that are propped up that get a lot of backing from anti-hunting foundations, which is a little counterintuitive. Yeah. If you look in people's tax forms and like 999 forms, I believe that's 990 forms. I believe that's what nonprofits have to go through. It's in the 900 mm-hmm. category, but whatever nonprofits have to file for that particular document, you'll sometimes see that they get questionable funding, but we can certainly talk more about that later. But I feel like every sector does get co-opted. Just because you see a lot in the far left, like saying, like, we have a handle on this issue, let's influence this and pour this money and then promote ideas that are counter to that. So it's really sad that they try to hijack a lot of it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I obviously dove way deep into these 990s when I was writing the book. So
yeah.
It's really interesting to see how much of it has been shifted from the original purpose of the group, you know, especially these large foundations like the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that is true. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So let's go back to the beginning here. I first got a chance to meet you in person at CPAC. What were your impressions of CPAC?
So that was my seventh CPAC, if I am not mistaken. I first went to CPAC in 2012 when it was still at the Marriott Wardman.
At the Wardman
in,
Park, yeah.
Yeah, in Washington, D.C. And I was a college senior finishing up at UC San Diego, and I went as a credentialed blogger. So it was one of my first conservative blogging experiences. And I've gone over the years through my work with Leadership Institute. I went with them for about 3-4 years. Then when I went on my own for the last 2 years, I've been going kind of solo, not really partaking in the speeches or segments, but I would just meet up with friends like for a day since I'm only 20 minutes away from the now Gaylord Hotel location. And this year I went with CFACT because I'm going to be collaborating with them, and they are a free market environmental organization that prides itself in true conservation, hunting, fishing, mixed sustainable use of public natural resources, excuse me, and is kind of been offering a counterbalance to what we see coming out about the Green New Deal, really extreme positions to environmentalism that tout preservation rather than conservation and calling you to sacrifice your lifestyle and put animals ahead of humans instead of offering a more symbiotic relationship between wildlife and humans. So it's a good organization. I used to work with them when I was at Leadership Institute, and I'm excited to partner with them. I'm actually going to be doing a untitled video series with them. I will announce the title very soon, but I'm working with them for a unique video series, so everyone can look out for that soon. And I could talk more about that later if your listeners are curious.
Yeah, definitely. I think that'd be a good idea. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'm kind of amazed that we haven't met each other before.
Maybe we did, because I used to go to BlogCon and all these other bloggers conferences before they did away with it. And one of my friends who writes for Town Hall, Matt Vespa, kind of lamented recently that at CPAC, and especially if you wanted to talk about this year's CPAC, because so many people were tweeting about it, about the aspects of it, and how there's a lot of this intra-party fighting among conservatives. And we see this, and we talk about this in our thread in The Resurgent. I won't reveal what exactly we talk about because that stays in the thread. But our writers and a lot of conservatives are having this conversation about, can you go to a place like CPAC, even with some of the bad aspects, but still enjoy the experience? And I'm of the belief that you can. And I've seen CPAC morph. I'm not the foremost expert on CPAC stuff, but I've gone, I've seen the changes. I think it's grown. Every year it ebbs and flows in terms of the attendance numbers. I think because now there is a Republican president, there's a lot more enthusiasm for attending because he speaks, the vice president speaks, other administration officials speak. And it just depends on the year who's speaking, but for certain, I think there is more interest in it and a lot of new faces. I saw a lot of younger people of very different, diverse backgrounds. I had not seen that before because everyone complains we're just an old white men's party or movement. And that is not true. Yes,
myself excluded, of course.
No, and there's nothing wrong with white men involved in Republican politics. Everyone's perspective matters. I think everyone can agree with that. But sadly, the media portrays it as it's such a singular movement and there's no say for anyone else. But that's not true. Women are very involved in the conservative movement. You have Black conservatives having a voice, leading charges, Hispanic conservatives, everyone, mm-hmm. everyone leads. And I think,
yeah, absolutely. You know, it's really funny to contrast what diversity means to conservatives versus liberals. Right. Because conservatives believe that diversity is diversity of thought, where they believe that diversity is just skin color and gender and that sort of thing. And everybody has to think the same.
Yeah, absolutely. And you will even see with intellectual diversity, people from unique, diverse backgrounds, inner city, first generation Americans, people from the Deep South, from the Midwest, from the Northeast, people of all different racial backgrounds and income levels. I've seen that a lot in my involvement. I can't say like I'm a seasoned political operative, but I'm close to 10 years in the conservative movement. I got a really early start at UC San Diego in 2009. So it's coming on 10 years of me formally getting involved. But in my near decade of young conservative activism, politicking, consulting, I've just seen that there were a lot of necessary changes that had to happen. I think we're seeing a more wider tent of people coming in, not feeling that they have to incline themselves to one particular party's views. I have a lot of friends of, and this is such a stupid thing, but you can't claim and cherry pick that you have friends that are of different backgrounds. But a lot of my friends who are Republican, who work in Congress, also happen to be not like me. They're not of a European background. They're not from the region I hail from. There's so many different people, especially now in the RNC and in Congress, congressional staffers, who are not your traditional so-called white conservative operatives. And it's so sad that, like, when we try to celebrate people, not only because of their diverse backgrounds, but because of their diverse perspectives, they get denounced and told that their perspective doesn't matter. They're a traitor to their race. They're a traitor to their gender. But there is a lot of different inklings of diversity in the Republican Party, despite what the media says. It doesn't get highlighted, sadly, a lot, but there's so many different perspectives and they have to be showcased. And I think CPAC does tend to do that, but even the greater movement as a whole. I think with President Trump kind of creatively disrupting and exposing both
That's
parties.
A good term for it.
Yes. I know a lot of people think it's volatile and violent creative disruption, but I believe
erratic.
I mean, yes, he's not, you know, polished. He's all over the place at times, but when you look at what he's done, it's hard to argue that it's not a conservative agenda. Not everything is perfect. I don't agree with the tariff stuff. Maybe that's used as a negotiating tool, and hopefully he won't implement those policies, but you don't agree with everything. But compared to a lot of his predecessors, I would say he's consistently proved a lot of conservatives wrong with selecting judges, supporting policy positions. He hasn't been perfect, of course, but I would say more so than anyone, he's exceeded a lot of people's expectations. That's the objective view from there. And I think someone like he'd have to come in and kind of expose the system, because conservatives have been complaining about there is bipartisan corruption, and that is really true. And we see
right
that.
And especially if you look at Congress and how yes. they've been completely ineffective in advancing an agenda. They yes. failed to repeal Obamacare,
Absolutely.
All of that stuff.
Yeah, and a lot of the reason why we see a small conglomeration, but small but loud conglomeration of never Trumpers who support Democrats over conservatives, it's a really counterintuitive position to take. But I'm of the belief that they're upset that they can't influence a Republican president, one, and two, they want to be popular at cocktail parties here in Washington, D.C.
That's always a bad mix.
Yeah. And I have friends in both always Trump categories, and I have some friends who are skeptical of Trump or somewhat never Trump. So in my writing at The Resurgent, I don't really take a position one way or another. I'm objectively critical. I think that's important. But I don't see the need to undermine his presidency. I have friends who work for his administration. I think that would be horrible of me to do, to not be supportive of them and their efforts to improve government and streamline certain policies.
Right. And that's the biggest thing, right, is that he's actually shown that he can be influenced by conservative ideas.
Yes.
And so the idea to undermine him is really cutting our noses off to spite our faces.
Right. And it's weird, even as a I kind of put my foot half in into politics, not 100% like I used to, because I do stuff in the outdoor industry. But just seeing kind of this fractious, divided movement, the kind of what I was saying, how a friend of mine, Matt Vespa from Town Hall, was saying, like, the blogger conservatives or the blogging efforts we used to have, the conferences, are no longer existent. And that's really sad because that brought people together. It allowed them to share
ideas. Well, it
brought
people together and it brought new voices into the movement, right?
Yes, yes. And there's such a proliferation of many new blogs. I see a lot of younger conservatives starting publications that are getting really good traction, and it's really positive to see. I myself had my hand in helping start some publications. I helped start the College Conservative. They brought me on as a founding editor, associate editor for that. I did a few blogs with my sister about cultural issues, previously Countercultured, which we retired, and a few other things. So as someone who has helped start up publications from a conservative perspective, I love the proliferation of more. Sometimes it's hard to keep track of all these sources coming out and news outlets blogs coming out. But I like that the market is welcoming more of those perspectives. But I feel that there is that structure to kind of guide people a little bit missing.
Yeah, it's not even that it's welcoming. It's just that there's so many new opportunities with blogging and podcasting. I mean, it's a never-ending universe that you can really find your own voice.
It is true. And if you weren't an early adopter of social media, there are some exceptions, though. It is really hard to make your name in politics, the outdoor industry, whatever industry you choose to be involved in. Some people have been able to bend those rules and overcome that. I have a lot of friends on Twitter who've actually grown their presence faster than I have, and some other of us who have been early adopters of social media. So it's not a foolproof explanation, but if you were an early adopter, you've played the game right, you've built up some Google searches, you have SEO optimization involved, people are tweeting about your stuff, sharing your stuff. That makes it a lot easier, but you don't have to be an early adopter of social media to get your say out there. If you happen to be a subject of a national story, you can easily grow your public profile. So it's interesting.
Yeah, you know, I look at a guy like Jesse Kelly, who I only met at the Resurgent Gathering in Austin in August. Right? I'd never even heard of the guy before, and all of a sudden he's like everywhere. You know, so there are opportunities to really explode onto the scene.
Absolutely, yeah. And he has a really unique perspective, having served in the Marine Corps. So people like the veteran's perspective. He cuts no corners. He's pretty funny. So he's a funny follow. He's pretty witty. And yeah, him getting banned on Twitter really did open up a lot of people's eyes to censorship issues that do happen on that platform. And I have to still watch the Joe Rogan interview where he interviews Jack Dorsey again, but he brought on two other people, another gal, I think, from Twitter. And
they admitted it.
Yeah. And then the guy from who used to work for Vice, Timcast, I think is his Twitter handle. I heard it's really interesting, so I'm going to watch that after our interview is done.
It's like being an air traffic controller at O'Hare, right? There's so many podcasts that you want to – it's just hard to organize it all, you know?
Yeah. But yeah, as going back to CPAC, because I kind of went off there, but it all is correlated to one another. CPAC does allow for newcomers to network, to get their say, to wet their feet in the movement in politics.
And that's the biggest issue, right, is meeting people and getting to know people and really getting close to influencers.
Yes, and making formidable, meaningful connections, because you can network a certain way where it's not meaningful and you ask someone for a card and say, hey, can you help me get an internship or this job, and you don't know this person and you can't vouch for them. Or the people who want to take time to talk to you, get to know you, and then you could be like, you know, you earned my respect, so maybe I will help you. Or I had a friend, Katie Johnson, I believe, she posted that she met a girl in the CPAC bathroom and asked for her card. And the girl's like, no, I'm good. Like, I have a job in the administration and I really don't want to connect with you. And she was kind of taken aback. Not because she's some important person. She works in one of the departments. But she was saying how that, like, there's no harm in accepting a business card or an invitation to grab coffee to network, especially if someone has lived in the D.C. area for a long time, can help you navigate.
Yeah, that whole town is run by relationships. Yeah. So why would you reject that premise?
I don't know, because unfortunately, within some young conservative circles, there's a lot of entitlement. That's with any movement. And they think because they may know someone who knows someone who knows someone in the administration, they're really important. And I've been told all my career that you're not going to be important until you've proved yourself. And it doesn't matter who you know. If people don't know you, it doesn't matter if you know someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows the president's son or the president. You can talk about connections, but it really won't make a difference unless people actually stake you out and claim they know you and can vouch for you and speak positively to your work ethic, experience and stuff. So I think a lot of people think, well, I know someone, therefore I'm important.
And that's the thing, you know, the town is run by relationships, but it's also run by people with massive egos.
Very true. And people ask me time and time again, how do I survive living here? So I live a comfortable distance away from DC, but not impossible. I maybe like...
Are you inside or outside the Beltway?
I'm technically inside the Beltway, but I live a comfortable distance. I live in the nice part of Northern Virginia, where by the Potomac River, not too far from everything, but not too close. So it's within like a 30-minute drive without traffic. So it's not bad. It's good. But having lived here for like 7 years, I have seen that. And whenever I hear of someone I've met before or friends that move here, I say, let me take you under my wing. I will help you not get sucked into the swamp and help you really adjust to the area. Because if you don't have guidance or you don't have a group of people, a social network, a solid group of friends who are like-minded or even not like-minded with it, whether it's in politics or your church or the outdoors or whatever conglomeration you belong to, if you don't have that center, you're going to get lost here. A lot of people get very dispirited, depressed, upset. They fall into bad habits. Then they want to leave the town. And there are many positives to living here. I don't let the circumstances in my environment prevent me from living my best life. I know that's a really millennial expression, living your best life, but I think in spite of your surroundings, you can make the best of the situation. And it's not like as stingy as New York City, Los Angeles, or Chicago. There are lots of opportunities to get away, to go to the outdoors, and other checks and balances you can impose on yourself to maintain some humility, to be grounded, and to stay focused and thrive here without losing your soul. So that's what I like to tell people. It's possible to do that.
It's possible, but you really have to take precautions.
You do.
So I wanted to, you talk about your outdoor activities and the opportunities you have in Virginia.
Yes.
So what got you started in getting involved in the conservation movement and the conservative side of that?
Sure. I've always been a lover of the great outdoors. I grew up in Southern California in Orange County. And at one point in time, I think it's still the case today, California is considered one of the best places for people who love the outdoors. I was growing up close to the Pacific Ocean. I lived maybe 10 to 15 minutes away from it in Laguna Beach, Laguna Niguel area. So I loved the ocean. I loved fishing from the Pacific Ocean. I also got to do a lot of freshwater fishing opportunities in nearby lakes. And I had memorable instances of catching some really notably sized fish. I caught a 8.9 pound catfish that was 28.5 inches long on Memorial Day 2003. So I have a very visual memory. I remember things like that. And even in spite of me living in California, I was able to not only develop my love of fishing, I also did a lot of hiking. Throughout my childhood, my parents took me and my sister on vacations to various national parks in and around California. I remember fondly going to Sequoia National Park, Yosemite National Park. I would also go to the Grand Canyon. I've been to Zion, Bryce, Grand Teton, and Yellowstone National Parks as well. So my parents were always very interested in ensuring that I wasn't always sitting on my bum watching TV. But growing up in the 90s, because I was born in 91, I'm actually turning 28 very soon on March 16th. So,
you're almost 30.
I know, I'm getting closer to there. So I still was I feel like your kids are growing up slightly different than how I grew up and my generation grew up, because we still did not have that proliferation of social media, smartphones, technology. So I think the earliest I accessed a smartphone was maybe my freshman year of college about 10 years ago. I had a flip phone most of my time in high school, and I shared that with my sister. So there were fewer distractions growing up in the 90s and the early 2000s. So I really was able to enjoy spending time in the outdoors. And my dad is that primary influence. He grew up fishing in the Soviet Union. I talked about that in a recent episode of my podcast, and he came on to share his story. I'm actually going to bring him on again for my upcoming episode to share more. We're going to break down some interesting topics that have been trending related to the outdoors.
And go ahead and plug that podcast. Yeah. What's the name of it?
It's District of Conservation, and we'll definitely get more into it throughout the podcast for sure. So having grown up with some semblance of a technology-free childhood, being exposed to fishing really early on, because studies have shown that if you start fishing or hunting even before the age of 12 or 13, the likelihood of you retaining that skill and interest stays with you throughout your whole life. So I was really lucky to, no pun intended, be hooked on fishing really, really early on. And my interest in firearms developed a little later after I graduated from UCSD. I actually shot my first gun in the fall or winter of 2010. I went to the mountains of San Bernardino to do some target shooting. And that's where I first learned how to shoot a shotgun, which I did not like at first.
Nice.
And then I also shot my first handgun. And it was interesting to do that. And I, having realized, you know, living in that state, there was just limited opportunities to really expose yourself to true firearm safety or shooting sport.
Yeah, California is a little bit nuts.
Yeah, I didn't realize the extent of that until I left for Virginia. And I knew there was a gun culture and even a smaller hunting culture to this day. And now we see the news from California's Department of Fish and Wildlife that they want to recruit hunters despite neglecting that effort. It doesn't help when your board is stacked with anti-hunters and people who don't like sportsmen. But that's it's typical because it's after Pete Wilson left, from my understanding, everything has just shifted even more far to the left, even in spite of even regardless of Arnold Schwarzenegger being governor. My parents even said he was worse than Gray Davis, and they
just he was not really a good Republican at all. And I'm up here in Oregon, so I kind of have the same opportunities. You know, my kids, I want, they're definitely hooked on their electronics. So I want to make sure that they get out in the outdoors, and we do a lot of hiking and camping.
Perfect.
And they're both in scouting programs, and
awesome.
I'm teaching them to shoot and all that stuff.
Excellent. Yeah. The right way. And I think you can bridge the gap between technological use and coupling that with opportunities in the outdoors. And there are a lot of apps that want you to be able to do both. I'm actually going to be writing about two of them. For Sporting Classic soon, so I will send you that link, and maybe your kids will have an interest in joining that if they're
That'd be great. I use All Trails just to make sure we can find good hiking trails. That's a good one.
Yeah, and these are specifically fishing and hunting ones, but when I finish those articles, I will certainly send them your way. Yeah, so the challenge now is, and kind of more of my backstory as to how I got interested in the outdoors. So I was able to live a virtually technology-free childhood. For the most part, I watched TV. I think everyone did growing up in the 90s too, but
couldn't avoid it.
Yeah. So I always had an interest. And with my foray into politics, I realized there were shortcomings, especially with the rise of alternative media or new media and the mainstream media putting out these unfair characterizations and reports on both shooting sports and hunting. And although I wasn't an active participant in both of those activities, I was realizing through research and talking to people with firsthand experience that their lifestyles were being under attack for no reason. And what I do currently and what I have always been doing in the most recent years is trying to shed a light on clarifying laws, exposing laws, talking about enforcement of certain laws related to handguns, talking about the implications of stripping away various different aspects of a handgun or a shotgun or banning guns altogether. Mischaracterizing firearms by using the wrong nomenclature. And also just recently, and what I do at the Resurgent is I try to peel away at the misrepresentation of how wildlife stories are documented, like in the recent case with the Colorado runner who fended off a 40-pound mountain lion. And people forget the velocity associated with a mountain lion or a big cat bite is very powerful. They can take down a small cat like that, much like an adult mountain lion cat, can take down a 100-pound deer.
The force and the jaws and it's not a small thing, you know?
No. So the media, like all these different outlets, NBC in particular, were like, this guy, he fended off an attack from a kitten. And it's not entirely inaccurate.
Some house cats are pretty vicious, you know?
Yeah. I mean, their characterization wasn't entirely inaccurate because wildlife biologists refer to mountain lion cubs as cubs or kittens, usually through the first year of life. And then once they leave their mothers, they, by age of two, they're self-reliant and can fend for themselves. But they were framing it like it's a domestic cat kitten, which it's not.
No.
Yeah, and if you didn't read through beyond the headline, you would be like, oh my gosh, he killed like this, like a little cub, those cute little things that are under like.
And it wasn't even that big a deal because it was only a kitten, you know? Yeah, come on.
And so they were like, he should have actually got what he had coming for killing this poor defenseless kitten. And I'm like, this is like the Disneyfication of wildlife. My friend Lauren.
That's right. Anthropomorphizing.
Yeah. My friend Lauren Hill, who works for Safari Club International, which is a great group. She has always told me like this is the proper term to use to describe inaccurate media reporting or salacious media reporting that doesn't reflect wildlife science or wildlife management efforts, because they're so influenced by Disney rather than like Nat Geo or
BBC America. They conflate them with domestic animals and pets and that sort of thing. We've got about 5 minutes left here on this segment, but for our listeners to the podcast, I also want to invite you to subscribe to our Patreon account, because I'll have a whole bunch of bonus material. This has been a fascinating conversation, so we're going to continue the conversation with bonus material exclusive to our Patreon patrons, which would be patreon.com/behindthecurtain with Jeff Reynolds. So check that out, but I want to wrap up this segment with Gabriella Hoffman. I want to ask you how we're doing as Republicans, as conservatives, communicating conservation issues, and how we're what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah, that's a very excellent question. So the National Wildlife Federation put out this interesting survey of about 800 anglers and hunters, and this was from 2012. And I want to cite this because this is important to note. Most people who partake in hunting and fishing tend to vote Republican and identify as conservative. And they said that 50% of those that they polled consider themselves conservative, of which 22% consider themselves very conservative, and that they viewed firearms rights and gun rights and conservation very equally. So there's already a natural attraction and interest in the great outdoors. And we are pretty big consumers, us who lean right. And there are some Democrats too, and in middle of the road centrist people. It's the outdoors isn't just for one particular party, but our consumers and the participants in the outdoor industry tend to vote Republican because of the associated activities with it, with firearms, with fishing. And we don't do a terrible job, but we could improve upon what we're already doing. And that's why I feel like involvement with groups like CFACT or learning about the different groups out there. There's the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation. There is the National Shooting Sports Foundation. There's also National Rifle Association, Gun Owners of America, and lots of other, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, National Wild Turkey Federation. So if Republicans got more interested in joining these groups, and a lot of them do, but they don't have to bring their politics with them. And you'll actually find among individual organizations and groups, people tend to share your political views and concerns. But I think it's a matter of highlighting the various accomplishments that hunters and anglers have been able to do, with especially contributing roughly at least 60%, and figures have differed between 60% to as high as 80% of conservation funding comes from hunters and anglers through excise taxes, in the name of firearms purchases, tackle, licenses, archery equipment, etc.
And well, isn't it also true that hunters and anglers and folks in general that are involved in these activities do a much better job of being stewards of the environment? Yes.
Yeah, because they drive most of the funding, and through their activities and how they recreate, their contributions are funding the wildlife and habitat restoration efforts. A lot of environmental groups love to talk a great talk about how they're protecting the environment. Those nasty Republicans are polluting it. But when it comes down to the monetary revenue that comes through excise taxes, it's mostly from hunters and anglers. And again, most of those hunters and anglers tend to vote Republican. So indirectly,
right, but even like, you know, landowners and those who are, it's not even the funding as much as the care that they take for their, yes, their land, right? And the animals, yes, that they hunt and fish.
Yes. Yeah. There is a standard in the North American model of wildlife conservation that's not really enshrined in law, but it's kind of a code of ethics that hunters and anglers, especially hunters, abide by. And they are good stewards, and they don't want overreaching government to tell them how to fish, when to fish, how to hunt, when to hunt. I mean, apart from basic guidelines, obviously you need basic regulations for bag limits, harvest numbers, and seasons change according to bag limits from before, weather conditions, things of that sort. So we will happily abide by the standards. But we do believe that when you have an apparatus like Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife, and it's actually under very good management now, compared to previous administrations. I'm very happy, right, to see that. But they want to empower state wildlife agencies to take care of situations or circumstances more than, let's say, giving extra power to the federal government, because they realize like they, the state wildlife agencies can work in concert with them better if they are more attuned to what's happening in their state, having more direction over it. And I think as limited government conservatives, you should support something like that, where you can, you don't have to abolish the federal entity, but you can support them, allowing state wildlife agencies to be better partners with them and to give them more say over the affairs of their states, especially out west with all the public land issues to that. And that's a whole nother discussion, because public land unfortunately divides a lot of people. And I'm of the belief that certain states do control relinquish their public land to federal government, and with the whole Antiquities Act, and that does really divide people. I've written about it at the Resurgence, so if people want to learn more about it, I kind of break down the divide and how you can have a limited government perspective while still supporting the conservation goals that have been set forth by the Pittman-Robertson Act, the Dingell-Johnson Amendment, the North American Model of Wildlife Conservation. So you can still be in support of conservation policies without supporting radical environmentalist policies. And I hope to play a small role in bridging the gap there. I know there are other entities out there that do. There's PERC, which is the property rights type group. There's
Property and Environmental Rights Commission or whatever. Up in Bozeman.
And then there's also that Pacific Legal Foundation. They do a lot of good litigation. They've been working with the Weyerhaeuser case with that timber company, which is actually in the Pacific Northwest, but it was related to a frog in Louisiana that doesn't live in Louisiana, but lives 50 miles away in Mississippi. So I think the Supreme Court unanimously ruled before Kavanaugh came that it's not clear, it's not endangered in that area because it doesn't live there. So that protection doesn't apply. And they, I think, sent it to the lower courts to deliberate that again.
And the abuses of the enforcement of the Endangered Species Act are an entire separate episode.
Oh my gosh, we could go so much into that. But briefly, just recently, I believe it was yesterday, the Department of Interior announced their intention to delist the gray wolf, because research has shown that the population and species as a whole has been returned to healthy numbers. Most recent figures point to the species being around a cumulative number about 5,700, and there are growing problems. Both wildlife agencies, wildlife biologists, and also other stakeholders like ranchers, cattlemen, private property owners have been complaining to the federal government and their state wildlife agencies that their livestock and even ungulate species like elk, mule deer, white-tailed deer are being preyed upon by this unmanaged population of wolves. And delisting, it should be noted, won't lead to the extinction of wolves. Nobody wants wolves to be wiped out. I like seeing wolves, much like I like seeing mountain lions. I grew up in Southern California.
And that's what they're supposed to be doing, is eating elk and deer instead of cows.
Yeah, no, but they do go after the wild cervid species too, and decimate them if they're not in check. But it's important to have a sustainable, managed, and I hate the term regulated, but in a highly regulated, managed hunt of these big game species and predator species, because if you let that run amok, that's going to disrupt the whole ecosystem below them. And they do play a critical role as apex predators. Again, no one is calling for them to be wiped out, but there does need to be a management system and management plan in place so that they don't wipe out the lower species and overtake those areas and have greater human wolf or human bear or human coyote conflicts.
Yes, because that's right.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, Gabriella, thanks so much. Gabriella Hoffman with me here on the Behind the Curtain podcast. And real quick, give a plug to where people can see your articles and where they can listen to your podcast.
Absolutely. So you can find my musings on politics and the outdoors at The Resurgent. If you Google, you'll be able to find me. I'm also found on Sporting Classics Daily. I've also started to write more for Field and Stream and Outdoor Life. I have a new piece coming out on the 10 best colleges for sportswomen and sportsmen. Coming out soon. So you can find that there. I'm on Twitter at Gabby_Hoffman, Instagram at Gabriella_Hoffman. I'm on Facebook as well. If you Google my name, you'll be able to find my public page or follow my private account. I have a follow option for those interested in following there. But I'm all over the place. I also run a consulting business, media consulting. That's my primary way of surviving and thriving. But it's at GabriellaHoffman.com. Also District of Conservation, for those of you interested in hearing more discussion about wildlife conservation from a conservative perspective. It's not an explicitly political podcast, but we do talk about politics, and I try to offer a balanced and even sometimes a conservative perspective on wildlife issues, public lands issues, just because people should hear what that is. And it's, we agree even with people on the left or in the middle, sometimes about proper management, public lands, but we don't want to see excesses and things be abused from there. So I think that's an important perspective. And I try to highlight that on my podcast, but I bring on people of all different political stripes if we just love the great outdoors and want to highlight things in the Mid-Atlantic and also federally speaking too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, Gabriella, thanks so much. And for the listeners of the Behind the Curtain podcast, please click over to our Patreon page, and we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to go a little bit deeper into gun rights and outdoors and communications with conservative issues and how we can kind of get over and convince and win hearts and minds. So, Gabriella, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I love chatting with you.
Reminder, there's another whole hour of conversation with my friend Gabriella Hoffman. We take a deeper dive into conservative messaging, the importance of conservation, and her family's fight for freedom moving from Lithuania to the United States. For more of me with Gabriella, check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/behindthecurtainwithjeffreynolds. If you like this podcast, the best way you can support is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to the Oregon story of the week with Josiah Underwood of Radian Weapons and our conversation about the Defend the Second rally on March 23rd. Welcome back to the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. My guest right now is Josiah Underwood of Radian Weapons of Redmond, Oregon. Josiah is helping to organize a rally in Salem to protest in favor of our gun rights. So the legislature is planning a massive gun grab, and we're going to talk about that now. Welcome in, Josiah.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
Yeah, all right. So I wanted to talk to you about all of these bad bills that are coming down and what we can do to fight them. What's your motivation behind all of this to get this rally going?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, basically, I've been in the gun industry for a few years. My brother has started Radian, been running it for about 10 years. And, you know, what we've noticed is that, you know, although everyone who works for firearms manufacturers tend to be fairly pro-Second Amendment.
You would think, right?
People, yeah, you think. Yeah, imagine that. Although we've been finding out that some people are not. Basically, what we've seen is this: there's been a hesitation at the corporate level to get involved actively and basically standing up to people that want to put us out of business and strip, you know, us as citizens of our rights that are supposed to be unalienable, protected by the Constitution. And so we just don't, you know, we kind of had a problem with that because it's at some point, you know, most companies think it's a better idea not to be political, and, you know, they're probably going to always be trying to sell their products to the government. And so they try to stay out of really kind of hot political topics. And, you know, we kind of want to change the that type of behavior if we can, and have people get more involved in being vocal about supporting their constituent, you know, their customers, and fighting back against what is essentially a never-ending onslaught against our rights. And, you know, as you and most of your listeners know, this is never going to end.
Right, and that's the problem. And so it's kind of a catch-22 for somebody doing business in Oregon, right? I mean, you know that as a gun manufacturer, you've literally got a target on your back. And so what's the best course of action? Do you want to call attention to your very presence, or you want to kind of, you know, keep your head below the trenches and not have to worry about being targeted by the government specifically?
Well, I mean, here's the deal. You know, we're conducting, you know, legal commerce in the U.S. And let's just say in a hypothetical world, they pass some of these bills, and the very firearms that we manufacture, which are all AR-15 based stuff, you know, it's a lot of accessories, but it's bull rifles as well. what's going to happen, and we've seen this on the East Coast, is, you know, they'll ban the guns, but they will not ban us from conducting legal commerce. They can't. It wouldn't stand up in the courts. And we'll go ahead and keep making parts. We'll go ahead and keep making guns and making money because we have a national customer base, and we'll be fine as a manufacturer. You know, Oregon's probably the 40th largest customer base by state in the whole U.S. You know, a lot of our customers are in larger populous states or states where guns are more prevalent, and so we'll be fine. The point is that, you know, the people who are citizens of our state and who are Americans are not going to be fine. They're not going to be able to exercise the Second Amendment in the way it was designed to be exercised. And your people that are at the retail level, you know, if you're a gun shop in, you know, Gresham, you're essentially going to be put out of business. You know, you just won't be able to sell enough guns and ammunition in order to make it a viable business option.
So now, you really think it's going to be that bad that the gun shops are going to be put out of business?
Well, I mean, think about it. If SB 501 gets enacted into law at the state level, the bill literally outlaws the sale of any firearm with a magazine of over 5 rounds. The only firearms that I know of that are like that are bolt-action rifles.
Right.
Even revolvers have 6 bullets that go into the cylinder. They will be outlawed. The bill also says you only be able to buy 20 rounds a month.
Now, yeah, that's not even enough to do it. That's not even enough to do a shotgun round.
Who's going to be able to do that? So basically, yeah, they're going to restrict commerce to a level that if you're at the retail level and you're really dependent on, hey, I need to sell, you know, 50 Glock 19s a week, you know, which is not that much. It's not even that many guns. And I need to be able to sell thousands of bullets to people who want to go shoot at the range or do whatever is legal. And they're not going to be able to do that. So that's really what is alarming to us, is that, you know, even since we started this rally and we've committed to putting all this money and brought all this attention and publicly stated, hey, we're going to fight back against whoever, if you're Republican, you're a Democrat, if you support this kind of legislation, you know, us as citizens and private business people, we're going to try to come after you and get you out of your seat. Because, again, this is absurd. It's like, at what level are we willing to put up with this stuff? And so we really need the people who are at the consumer level and just care about the Constitution, and at the retail level, who will basically be put out of business by this type of legislation. They need to get involved. Now's the time. You know, there's a supermajority of Democrats in the House and Senate, and they can do whatever they want. And unless there's a really big stink with a lot of people who come and tell them, hey, no, we're not going to put up with this. And if you do pass these laws, one, we're not going to comply. And then two, we're going to really come after you in the next election cycle, because let's be honest, the Republican base in Oregon, or people who are generally more conservative or generally support the Constitution, are not very active, because it's a pretty blue state. You know, they don't feel a lot of hope in being able to really affect a lot of change here because of, you know, the urban population centers in Salem and Eugene and Portland kind of dominating the political landscape.
Yeah, you know, I've always said that the one thing you don't do is you don't come after the guns of Oregonians. I think that regardless of political stripe, that's one thing, especially outside of Portland, you know, even Lane County or Marion County, there's a lot of gun owners. You know, get outside of Multnomah County, then you really are treading on people's rights, and they know it, and they're not going to put up with it.
For sure. And that's the thing that's interesting about Oregon, and what's going to be interesting, you know, what we're kind of trying to make this event that we're doing in Salem on March 23rd about is, you know what, like us specifically, you know, we all have our own political views. We all have our opinions on all these hot topic items that are constantly in the American discussion in politics. But our aim specifically as a manufacturer and as people putting on this event and who are then going to be involved politically in Oregon for years to come, hopefully, is that we're nonpartisan, right? You can be a liberal Democrat who lives in Portland and still recognize that what they're proposing is draconian. Because if you have a lever action Marlin 22 that your dad gave you in 1975, and you don't turn it over to the state or get it out of the state of Oregon, you're committing a felony, because, you know, based on the laws that they're proposing. And anybody who's reasonable understands that that's absurd, right, for that kind of legislation to be put in law.
Yeah, you know, and this is, I have a friend that's put this into terms that are hit a little bit closer to home, because a lot of women carry for self-protection, and this is a direct assault on a woman's right to be able to defend themselves.
Of course it is. Of course it is. And it's they're literally, you know, what this ends up doing in this type of legislation, it ends up not really affecting, you know, your 30-something-year-old white dude who's well off and has a ton of guns and, you know, knows a lot about laws and stuff. Who this affects are people in urban centers or rural communities who don't have the same kind of means that some of us do, who, you know, they want to carry a revolver to protect themselves. They get pulled over in North Portland on a routine traffic stop, and all of a sudden they're getting slapped with a felony for having some gun that was designed in the 1800s. I mean, that's essentially what they're proposing. And
yeah,
it's ludicrous, right? So, you know, I'm going to be fine. I'll be okay, right? I'll figure it out. I'll always have my guns. I have a ton of guns already. It's going to be the person who doesn't have a ton of money to spend on, you know, a Glock 19 or whatever they need to defend themselves, and then who's worried about their boyfriend beating them to death or some other sort of domestic violence situation, who then has to wait 120 days for a license in order to go purchase a gun. They're the ones who are who are most affected by this type of legislation.
Well, and you combine that with the sanctuary state laws, and you saw the brutal rape and beating of that woman in 2017 in Northeast Portland, and the guy was an illegal. He was a meth addict, and he had a violent past. He had a rap sheet a mile long. I bet a gun would have been pretty handy in that situation.
I bet it would have been too. And I mean, again, it's not even really. It's, you know, violent stuff happens. And the whole reason we have a constitution and with all these amendments in it are so that we have, you know, the autonomy and the means in order to basically be self-governing and be, you know, responsible for our own welfare. You know, we have a Second Amendment so we can repress a tyrannical government if it ever gets to that point. We have it so we can protect ourselves. And really, all these bills and this basically, they're basically trying to kill the Second Amendment through passing, you know, these like sneak around bills that basically just make it so hard to exercise your right.
Right.
That it limits to the very few people with the financial means and the wherewithal to dig through all the, you know, bureaucracy in order to exercise their rights. It's death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I mean, it's, you know, it's just a little infringement, so it's not that big a deal, right? You know, that's right. Basically their reasoning.
Yeah, sure. And it's been going on for years. And really, you know, to be frank, there's a lot of, it's very disappointing from many of the major gun rights organizations like the NRA, you know, who gets vilified on TV all the time as being this really horrible organization that's, you know, basically in favor of killing children or whatever.
Yeah.
But to be completely frank with you, I'm really disappointed in their constant acquiescence. So, I mean, we're at the point where because what they do, what the people that try to ban our rights do, they make the starting point extreme, right? So if SB 501, the really draconian bill that's in the House right now, probably is not going to get passed into law right off the bat, but parts of it will, and they'll negotiate backwards from like their crazy proposals, and they might increase the round count that you can buy months to 200 or something, but that's the starting point, right? And
right.
They always negotiate backwards, and the people that we have elected to basically defend our position that's the starting point that they always have to go from, and then they end up acquiescing something away, and then they're like, oh, we compromised. At some point you can't compromise anymore. It's just like, we already at a level of restrictions on common use firearms. I mean, there's the National Firearms Act, there's the Gun Control Act, which it's already ridiculous what we have to go through just to exercise our rights. And they're just going to continue to the onslaught of, hey, incremental reduction of our freedom.
So you keep referring to the exercise of our rights. Mm-hmm. What would you say to folks on the other side of the argument that say, well, you know, that our rights were written in the Constitution a long time ago, and Things have changed, and you know, we keep having these mass shootings that we never had when the Constitution was written, and so
Well, I mean, what would I say to them? I mean, it's a really long discussion, and if you're really going to dive into that, you need some time. And there's been a few different times where I'll be on an airplane or whatever, and I'll end up talking to someone who's
captive
generally
audience.
Anti-gun, right?
Yeah.
And you get into this, and you talk to them, and by the time you talk to them and get through it, they're at least a lot more open to what your ideas are, because I mean, you have to talk about a lot of different things. One, most people who've been affected by violence from a firearm or has witnessed a lot of mass shootings on TV and are really affected by that, they're usually not even in a frame of mind where they're even considering the meaning of the Constitution, why we have it, what it does for them in general. And
They just want a solution to the problem, right? And that's the easiest solution to come up with.
Of course, right? And if you're talking in real numbers, you know, obviously violent crime in the U.S. in general is going way down since even the early 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
You know that AR-15s are only used in like 2% of all violent crimes in general. It's all handguns typically, and suicides creating most of the deaths in our country.
Yeah, 2/3 of the gun deaths are suicide.
Exactly. And to people who are watching CNN or even Fox or whatever with these little sound bites, you know, you don't get way into the conversation, which you have to, which in order to change someone's mind about something that they feel very strongly about, because obviously nobody wants to see school kids getting shot at a high school, right? And that makes a really big emotional response. And lawmakers' immediate, you know, reaction to those types of events is, we need to do something. And it doesn't matter what it is. We just have to throw something on paper. But, you know, the of course, the inverse effects of doing that are unintended consequences that are pretty bad. And, you know, to me,
well, it's not even the unintended consequences. I mean, the measures that they propose won't solve the problem.
Exactly. Right. And politicians are not, you know, intellectually honest enough to acknowledge that. And a lot of times they'll just say, well, we have to do something, even though what you're saying and your rational arguments are destroying my position. We have to do something. And to me, it comes more down to long-term leftists, and even a lot of the people in the Republican side, they just want more power. And they know that by disarming us, you know, they're going to be in a more powerful position, and it's fairly nefarious. Other people are literally just stupid and aren't willing to deal with facts, and they just want to pass legislation to say they did something to stop violence against children or whatever.
Yeah, you know, all you need to look at is Venezuela, right? I mean, over the weekend, they were blowing up aid trucks that the people would continue to starve. They had voluntarily given up their firearms by referendum a few years ago.
Of course. And you know what? It's a lot easier to subjugate people that don't have any guns. And, you know, I can speak from personal experience, and we can look at an example that's very recent. You know, the most mighty military in the planet, with all of its strength, money, drones, tools, has been fighting in Afghanistan for, you know, basically 20 years at this point. And the only thing that, you know, the Taliban has to fight us back with are AK-47s and fertilizer, right? And they've done a pretty effective job of holding out.
Yeah.
And being non-repressed, right? I've been there twice myself. And, yeah, we kill a lot of those people, and we have a tactical advantage at all times, but we've never been able to subjugate them, because they have guns, right? And it's pretty rudimentary what they have. So when people make the argument, oh, what is the U.S. population going to do against a truly tyrannical government?
With 400 million guns, we can do quite a lot.
Right? You can do a lot. And so, I mean, obviously they can nuke us off the map, but, I mean, that would be a kind of a zero-sum end game for them, too. So the point is, yeah, you can do a lot with semi-automatic rifles and handguns, right? You can defend yourself against tyranny and being starved if our country ever becomes socialist and we run out of resources, and, you know, the whole tired argument. It's obvious. So we decided that, hey, basically, now's the time to, you know, in spite of the fact we're a business and we're successful and we're selling a lot of guns and our business won't go away even if these laws pass in the state of Oregon, you know, as citizens and people who care about our rights and our community, we need to try to do something to fight back.
Well, that's very much appreciated. One more time, give a plug for your business real quick.
So the business is radiant weapons. Primarily, we're selling high-end AR-15 accessories like charging handles and safeties. We do have a complete rifle lineup. You can visit us at radiantweapons.com. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And we're currently selling a special edition charging handle safety combo that's real expensive, but every single penny is going towards this event. Our company has committed $100,000 to fund various things like commercial advertising, flyers, the event costs like stages, flags, all that kind of stuff. And then we're actually going to be paying for buses to actually bring people in who care about the Second Amendment from across the state.
Wow, that's quite a commitment. I didn't realize it was that big a commitment you guys are making.
It is, yeah. So again, we're raising a lot of the money through selling these parts, which obviously we can manufacture for very little cost. But anything that we don't make up from that, we will commit with cash commitment to actually paying for all these things. Here in Portland, you're going to start hearing radio ad that we've recorded. And, you know, we want people, we want everyone to feel included in this event. This is not a partisan event. This is not a political event in the sense that, you know, we're really, you know, Republican or anything like that. We know that there's a lot of people in our state that, you know, probably don't align themselves ideologically with most gun owners on a lot of issues. But the thing that I think we can all agree on is, you know, the Constitution is the basis of all of our freedoms in the U.S., and so we need to support it when it's under attack. So we're trying to get as many people out there from as many backgrounds as possible.
And there's no question it's absolutely under attack. And, you know, just a quick aside, in my book, I just wrote a book, and I talk about how the Second Amendment, the First Amendment, Article of the Bill of Rights, every amendment, I should say, of the Bill of Rights is under attack by people who consider the Constitution an impediment. What they really want is more power. And
of course,
you know, they may have altruistic goals, supposedly, or you know, their heart may be in the right place, but they know that they can't change people's behavior the way they want it to be changed without that political power.
Of course. Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so give us the details on the event. I know you're organizing some buses too, right?
We are. So the final details about bus locations haven't been hammered out yet. We've been doing some Facebook polling in order to kind of determine the best places to invest in that, because it is a big expense. You can expect to have buses from a coastal city, Portland, probably Medford, and Redmond, and probably Pendleton is what we're thinking at this point. We're asking that people kind of rally together and do carpooling and bring extra seats. Unfortunately, the whole bus situation is a big expense, and you don't get a ton of seats. I think we're probably going to end up spending about $50,000 on buses, and you're getting about 1,000 people to be able to show up. So we're going to need people to kind of – yeah, I mean we're going to have – at this event, I think you're going to see a lot of people there. It's gotten a lot of traction. You can visit the event page on Facebook. It's the Defend the Second Rally there. And I think that, you know, people realize what's happening. And by us taking a public stand and using our information channels that we have available to us, we've been able to get a lot of people aware of this event. We have sitting senators and congresspeople who are in favor of the Second Amendment, who will defend our rights, who are going to be speaking at the event. Adam Kraut, who's running for board of directors in the NRA, will be flying in. We'll have some other speakers there. And, you know, we're trying to make it a good event, right? So you go to these rallies a lot of times, they're pretty sad because it's not enough organization. And
there's kind of no point to them. And there's no action item or you know, momentum right to be carried forward, right?
Right. And so we're going to have information for people there to hopefully take and really act on. Hopefully they get excited because they see that there's actually some momentum on the side of freedom to where they can get involved at the county and state level politically in order to protect their rights. We'll be passing out that information. There's going to be a stage there where people will speak from, and we'll have music, a band is playing, and we've got vendors who will be providing food and drinks. So it's hopefully going to be an important event for defending our rights, but something that people can kind of get behind coming to on a Saturday and you know, having was essentially fellowship with other people that care about, you know, our freedom. So we're hoping it's going to be a good event. If people want to get involved, please just come to the event page sign up for going. Try to volunteer for it if you can. We're also accepting donations through a GoFundMe. If you search Defend a Second on GoFundMe's website, you'll find our event page. We've gotten, just in over a couple of weeks here, we've gotten almost $6,000 from small contributions from people who care about our rights.
Wow, that's great.
People from out of state that see what's happening are giving us money. We expect here to have several other manufacturers, to include Oregon companies and companies from out of state that are going to help support us on this. So we're hoping to make it a really big event. And, you know, if we get 4,000 or 5,000 people out in Salem on a Saturday to speak out, that's going to send a really strong message to some of these legislators and give them pause on, you know, essentially attacking our liberties. And
yeah, especially those rural Democrats that are worried about reelection. Those guys have to know that there are going to be gun owners that will not vote for them if they vote the wrong way. You know,
absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. So there's a lot of not super strong Democrats in the House and the Senate. And there's a lot of Republicans that really can't be counted on from some of the more urban counties. And
that's
so
true.
We have to let them know that on especially this issue, you know, there's many issues that are important to citizens of Oregon. There's a lot of bad things happening in our state from a legislative standpoint. But, you know, when it comes to the Constitution, that's something that we can all agree on that is off limits. And if you attack it, we're going to come after you.
Well, there's a specific reason why the Second Amendment comes right after the First Amendment in importance in the Bill of Rights. You know, the First Amendment protects speech, assembly, religion, and the Second Amendment gives citizens or reaffirms the right of the citizens to defend those rights in the First Amendment. So there's a reason it's right there at the top of the list.
If you don't have a Second Amendment, it's not too long until your first is gone.
That's exactly right.
Or any of the other ones. So, I mean, if you don't have a means to enforce your will against what is essentially tyranny, you don't have. They're just going to do what they want.
Yep.
And we've seen that historically. You know, you can go through the 20th century and pick up, you know, 100 examples of that.
Yeah, Mao Zedong said, "Power comes from the barrel of a gun."
It's true. So
yep.
It's really important. We hope that we can get a lot of people on board with us to, you know, not only get involved with us on this event, which will be a very public spectacle on people saying no to tyranny, but then on the follow-on action items as well. We got to get involved. We got to stand up for our rights.
Yep, and get involved in elections going forward and make your electoral power known. Because this is the way we change things is by saying this, you know, draw the line. You shall not pass. This far you shall not come.
Absolutely.
Yep. All right. Well, Josiah, I'd really appreciate it. I will be there on the 23rd, and I will look forward to meeting you in person. And thanks for being on my show.
Absolutely. Thanks for the opportunity, Jeff. I really appreciate you spreading the word.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll do everything I can to bring as many of my friends as I can.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for checking out Behind the Curtain Podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next Wednesday for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Great-grandpa sailed here from across the ocean. Nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion. But deep down in his heart, he knew he was right. He cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sings, I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along, and that's what makes this country so strong. Oh. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. And just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud.